right, to introduce Shiv Prasad. Jill is one of the heroes of quantum information, sort of behind some of the most important discoveries in the field. So, the DB84 cryptography protocol is what started the field of quantum cryptography. The quantum teleportation paper, I think in my mind, was the first really real quantum information paper, certainly that sort of got me interested in the field. So really interesting happening there. And again, Joe was with Chris was suggesting that we should look to axiomatizations of quantum theory from these information theoretic principles, and had some very specific proposals along those directions. So again and again and again, Jill has made this happen. And so I think, and also numerous honors. So I can't remember the title of the Canadian, that is what they call you. It's basically the equivalent of a knighthood. If he was British, it would be Sir. I think in Canada they got rid of those titles.
Well, if you're referring to member of Phil of the Royal Society of Canada.
No, I wasn't going to tell them. I went to the other one, the Canadian kind of thing. Anyway.
Well, there's a Herzberg Medal and a Canada Prize.
Yeah. Anyway, we're very lucky to have Jill here, and we're hoping that yet again this we're going to see. So please.
All right, thank you. Thanks a lot.
All right, so this is joint work with my student, Paul-Henri Morin-Bichon. And the reason for this title is that in 2005, so about a bit more than 10 years ago, I was invited by Nature Physics, before it existed, to contribute a commentary in their first issue. So in volume 1, number 1, page 2, I wrote this paper, "Is Information the Key?" Hence, out of this talk, information is the key! Exclamation point. And at that time, I was interested in making information central into the foundations of physics or quantum physics. Asking the question, could it be that the truly fundamental laws of nature concern information and not wave and particles? And this has been taken on by many people. I think it's been mostly solved, at least to some level. And Lucien was one of the earliest people to work on that, in fact. But to be honest, it was not my idea. Really, Wheeler, as far as I can tell, Wheeler was the first person to ask this question. And Chris Fuchs tells me that already in the 70s, Wheeler was asking his best students to derive quantum theory from an information theoretic principle. So. This program has been going on for a long time. And again, I think that there has been some really, really great progress done on this front. And somehow this is not what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to talk about the importance of information, but not in the way that I was thinking of in those days. In those days, the question was to reformulate quantum theory by around principles that would be that would have to do with information. Today I'm going to talk about using information inside the foundations of quantum mechanics, but in a different way than what I was thinking of in those days. All right. The first time I gave this conference, the current version of this conference, was last week in London, Ontario. It was a conference held by philosophers. That's why I'm talking about Plato and Kant. But I decided to keep this slide because it's kind of interesting. Not that I have anything against philosophers, but So Plato and Kant were interested in what they called a noumenal world. And the noumenal world is the world of all that there is. And the way Kant described it it's not even clear it exists in Kant's mind, but it's completely unknowable through our sensations, which does not mean that it's unknowable through our thoughts. We can think about it, but we cannot really know it. And this is to be compared or contrasted to the phenomenal world, which is what can be perceived. So the phenomenal world is I'm going to define it as what can be apprehended. So where the noumenal world is all that there is for real, well, that's all that's really out there, the phenomenal world is what can be apprehended. I'm not going to limit our apprehension to our just senses, human senses. We're allowed to use unlimited technology to help us. Where, of course, you understand that when I say unlimited, I do mean, in fact, limited by the laws of physics. And there is a mapping from the noumenal to the phenomenal world. We could denote it by phi because it rhymes with phenomenal. Well, anti-rhymes, phi. It's an epimorphism, meaning that any state that can be apprehended comes from a real state, a state of reality. Otherwise, it's not worth talking about. That's the epi part of it. And it's a morphism because this thing is going to preserve all kinds of structure, as we will define mathematically in a moment. This mapping cannot be one-to-one in the sense that there are worlds that can be apprehended. Sorry. There are states that can be apprehended that could come, exactly the same state that can be apprehended can come from many different real states, noumenal states. And if you're familiar with the Lorentz principle, this goes against it. And if you're not, that's fine. And I don't care that it goes against it. Fine. Now, people in foundations have been using the word ontic for a little while, many years, by which an ontic state is meant to be what's really there. If it exists, whether the ontic state exists or not is a matter of debate. But people have used the word ontic to mean exactly what I mean here by what Plato meant by noumenal. And the reason I'm going to use a different word than what's been used in the foundations of physics recently is not just to be different. It's not because I think that Plato being before takes precedence. It's because ontic has been contrasted with epistemic. And whereas what I mean by noumenal is the same as others mean by ontic, phenomenal is entirely different from epistemic or doxastic. Now, epistemic means what is known. Ontic or noumenal, which is the same, is what's there. Whereas epistemic is what is known, and the doxastic is what is believed, which is kind of weaker. For instance, the cubist people believe that the word is doxastic. We can only talk about states of belief. Others think that we can talk about what is known, but not what there is. Ontic people think we can talk about what there is. I'm one of them. And the big difference between phenomenal and epistemic is that the phenomenal state is what can be apprehended, not necessarily what has been apprehended. So you go from one to the other by making, if you make measurements or if you make observations, then you will learn something. It will become epistemic. Whereas phenomenal is all that there is that could be learned. And in the same phenomenal state, you could have many things that could be learned, but in quantum mechanics, we know that maybe if you decide to learn this, then you can no longer learn that. So there could be epistemic states or things you could learn, but you cannot in the phenomenal state, but you cannot learn them all. You can learn, choose which one to learn. So epistemic is really quite different from phenomenal. And that's the reason why I'm going to talk about noumenal instead of ontic, although they are the same, because I'm going to contrast it with something else than what people usually do. Good. So this is about, so far I really talked about the entire world, the universe. But since we are limited, we're going to be more interested about the state of systems. A system is just any part of the universe that you care about. It could be small, it could be bigger, it could also be the whole universe. So let's move about state of the system, instead of state of the world, state of the system. And therefore, I'm not talking about the world anymore, but a system. Any system will have a noumenal state and a phenomenal state. And again, there's this mapping, which is not one-to-one. Now, we're interested in evolution of systems. So let's say that we're here at time t0. We apply some transformation, some operation, some unitary. And the state of the world, the state of this system will move, the noumenal state will move from where it was at time t0 to something else at time t1. And nothing very deep here. And the same epimorphism here can be applied there, thus defining a phenomenal state at time t1. Now, what I want to stress is that in this view of the world, we can only operate on noumenal states. It reflects on the phenomenal state, but we cannot operate directly on phenomenal state. So all the operations, we can only manipulate directly the phenomenal state. Nevertheless, even though we do not manipulate directly the phenomenal state, did I get it wrong? We can only manipulate the noumenal state. So even though we do not manipulate the phenomenal state directly, this operation translates back here through the epimorphism, because it's a morphism. That's why it's defined correctly. I'm sorry. I should say that this thing is known as an epiphenomenalism, whatever. This exactly means what I just said, which you can only operate on the noumenal state. So, anyways. This transformation gives rise to one at the phenomenal level. And it's well defined because phi is a morphism. Good. I use the same symbol, not because I'm sloppy, but because I don't want, instead of thinking of U as a mapping from here to here, U is an element of the structure that acts on noumenal and phenomenal states. So it's probably going to be, in quantum mechanics, it will be, the structure will be a group. But it could be another mathematical structure. It could be a monoid. It doesn't have to be a group. So we're talking about the notion of group actions. And it's the same U as a group element will act both on noumenal and phenomenal states. Although the action itself that the same U does will be different depending on which level it's acting. All this to justify that it really is the same U as a group element, but the way that this group act, but it's a different group action whether we're at this or that level. All right. And the whole point is that this diagram commutes. It commutes meaning that whether if you start from some state of the real world here, and you act upon it, and see and consider what can be apprehended about the result, you get the same phenomenal state as if you had first seen what you can tell about the system, and then acting on it at this level. But again, physical actions are only made on this level. Yes?
Given the way that it looks like you might have many different translations at the top corresponding to the same translation at the bottom.
Well, there are many states at the top that will correspond to the same state here.
Right. And likewise on this side.
But likewise on this side. However, again, because it's a morphism and it's done mathematically carefully, any action here, to any action here, will correspond one precisely defined action there.
Did you mean this specifically for quantum systems, or
no,
for thermodynamics? You could imagine many different sort of say, mixing operations to produce the entropy or increase the entropy that are clearly distinct at the nominal level, but give rise to the same change in the thermodynamic quantities at the nominal level.
In terms of which function, which mapping is applied from here to here, there could be several different mappings that would give rise to the same here. In terms of group element, it's the same group element, which acts in a different way. All right. Now, to save space, I'm not going to write noumenal and phenomenal any longer. I'm going to represent the noumenal states by the symbol M for some reason. So that's the state of system A at time 0, the noumenal state of system A at time 0 and at time 1. No good reason to use M except that they're going to be matrices in the actual formalism. However, for the phenomenal state, I think you can guess which symbol I use. Because these are states of, this is about all that can be apprehended, which in quantum mechanics, of course, is a density matrix. So I'm going to represent the phenomenal states by rho of system A at time 0 and 1. OK. Now, we can split systems, meaning that if I have a composite system, A, B composed of system A and system B, then I can split into A and B. And I'm going to do that with a mapping that I will call pi, as in projection. So if I project onto A, if I project the noumenal state of AB onto the noumenal state of A, I use the projection onto system A. Same thing for B. Now, in quantum mechanics, we're more used to use the trace operation. You can think of pi A as trace over B. Or trace over the rest of the universe, except A. I prefer to think to talk in terms of projections instead of trace, because somehow, at least in some sense, it's more natural mathematically. And also, you don't have to care about what's the rest of the universe. You just project whatever it is here. You can project just on A. It's kind of simpler. But it's the same. Now, when you split a system like this, this reflects, again, this is at a noumenal level. Red would be noumenal always. When you split them at a noumenal level, it induces a splitting at the phenomenal level in a most natural way, using the same epimorphism phi. And the way that this is done is so that it induces also projections at the phenomenal level, which I will denote by the same symbol. This time it is an abusive notation. The same symbol is used for two things which are different, but there's no confusion because depending on whether it acts at noumenal or phenomenal level, in either case, it does mathematically a projection. And so this, the epimorphism here will induce this projection from this one. And again, because it's a morphism, it's well-defined. And now, this diagram commutes again. What this means, if you look at this part, it means that whether you split a composite system at a numinal level, look at the A part numinally, and what the phenomenal system that corresponds to it, you get the same thing as if you first look at the phenomenal state of the composite system and then project. And this pi A is really what's denoted trace B, trace over B, in usual quantum mechanics here, because we're talking about the normal, the usual density matrices. So this is the trace operator, but on B, which I will call projection on A. All right, so this commutes, and that commutes as well. Nothing deep at all so far. Just setting the stage. Okay, now it gets more interesting. So not only can we, let me say something first. What I'm talking about at this level, at the moment, is not quantum mechanics. It's an arbitrary physical theory. And quantum mechanics will fit in it, but it's not restricted to quantum mechanics. So I talk about quantum mechanics now and then just to help you put your intuition, because you're familiar with it, but there's really no intention to restrict quantum mechanics. All right, so just before, we've seen that a system can be split, and nobody's surprised. But systems can also be joined. So if I have the numinal states of A and B, I can use a join operator, to get, which is denoted by this, so that I can join the numinal states of A and B and get the numinal state of system AB. And this has to be, in fact, MAB. So this join operation takes all that there is, not all that there is in system A and all that there is in system B, puts them together and gives us all that there is in systems A and B. If this sounds unfamiliar in quantum mechanics, that's normal. Again, we can play the same game and look at what happens at the phenomenal level. And if we do that, then both AB and AB have phenomenal versions. And we could try to join it, but we can't. So at the phenomenal level, you all know, of course, that the density matrix that describes an entangled system AB, yes, you can project into rho A and rho B, but from rho A and from rho B, there's no way that you can put it together and get rho AB when the AB system is entangled. However, what I claim is that, so this is true, at a phenomenal level, I have no problem with that. Standard quantum mechanics tells us at a phenomenal level, you cannot compose systems. If you know all there is new about system A, which in conventional quantum mechanics means all that can be perceived or apprehended, and all that can be apprehended about system B, there can be many solutions to the composed system. And so you don't know which one is good. But the main thing I posit here is that this incompleteness at the phenomenal level does not have to reflect at the numinal level. And this is exactly why we need numinal states. In conventional quantum theory, we stop here at the phenomenal level. But what I claim is that if we look a bit further at the numinal level, then this impossibility of combining states can be circumvented. In other words, the 1935 EPR paper asking the question, is quantum mechanics complete, essentially? Well, the answer, I'm very sorry to say, was no. It is not, the standard quantum mechanics is not complete. But yes, it can be completed, despite what you've been taught. Okay. All right. And the requirement of this joint operator is that if you start with a noumenal state and you split it with the projection operators into two noumenal systems for A and B, it is possible to combine it back into the join of M, E, N, and B, and these are identical. You don't lose anything. Now, when you do that, it's not obvious it can be done. Right? What I'm saying at the moment, I will show you later how it can be done. But what this really says is that quantum physics, seen that way, is a local theory. When you have a system that describes all there is to know about, all there is, not only can be apprehended, but if you have all there is about system AB, you can split it, and you have two local systems in which you can operate separately, and then you can put it back together, and you get what you'd want to get. And everything can be done in at a purely local level. And again, of course, even if A and B are entangled, that's why it's interesting. You can also do evolve systems separately. For instance, you have system AB at time zero. You can split it into systems A and B. You can evolve A and B separately by different, or the same as you want, unitary operators. And you can combine them again. And if you do this, if you split A and B into two systems, two separate systems, which you may or may not bring apart from one another, you can keep it there, or you can bring them at two ends of the galaxy, makes no difference. Once A and B are split, you can act on each one of them, you can recombine, and what you get after all this is the same as if instead, this is counterfactual, as if instead you had just done U tensor V to the original system. You get the same thing. And I use a different color here just to emphasize that you have a choice. You do blue or black. You cannot do both.
Why do you say it's counterfactual? Isn't it just
again?
Why do you say it's counterfactual?
Because you cannot do both.
Talking about the same thing.
Yeah, a counterfactual in the sense that you cannot do both. You have to choose to. Well, yeah, it is the same thing, actually. You're right. It is the same thing.
Okay.
All right, so in a sense, it's not counterfactual. It's the same thing. And here I wrote I didn't use the usual tensor product notation because this is more general in quantum mechanics. In quantum mechanics, it would be the tensor product of the two operators. Now, no signaling. Any theory that is no signaling, what it means is that if you have the phenomenal state of a composite system AB, and you do something on A and B, and then project onto A, what you get here is as if you had only done U on system A. So to say that the diagram commutes essentially means that if you have a system AB, no matter what you do in the B system, has no effect on what can be apprehended about the A system. So because here this diagram is at the phenomenal level, it's only about what can be apprehended. So there's no signaling possible. You cannot, by manipulating the B system with anything, any V you want, manipulating the B system will not allow anything on the A system to be apprehended differently. That's what this says. This says nothing about a noumenal level. This is strictly a phenomenal diagram. If we rewrite this at a noumenal level, if instead of looking at what can be apprehended about system AB, if we talk about what system AB is, about the real noumenal state of system AB, then after you do the same U tensor V, you get something at time one for AB. And we can look at what happened in the A system. So this is an entirely different diagram. And if this one commutes, it's very different from what I said before. To see that this one commutes means that after you've done U on A and V on B, that system A is in the same state as if you had only done U on A and not touched B at all. And that's not non-signaling. That's locality, which is quite different. And I add realism here because these if we talk about these nominal states, if systems can be described by nominal states, that's a state of existence. So that's a realist approach. So to see that that this diagram commutes is stronger than the no signaling diagram before. And this, so again, this really means that there is no, not only no observable effect at distance, but no effect at all.
So I don't understand this. So localism, you have something you're changing on one side that affects what happens at the other side?
Well, it doesn't because it commutes.
Or a Schultz effect, right? So that, where is the thing that, I can't understand this. Is it V that doesn't affect?
It means that, that's right. So no matter what V you do on system B, has no effect on. In any case, you do U on A, okay. And the result is the same regardless of what V you do on B.
So if this were true for all V, that would be both.
This is true for all V.
Yeah.
That's right. For any system A B, entangled or not, no matter which V you do on B, it has no effect on what will happen on system A when you do U. So that's really what I think should be the definition of local realism. Okay, now we get to why this is the whole point of this. So far it's only definitions, it's mostly philosophy. And the whole point of this is these two theorems. The first theorem is that any local realistic theory of the way that I've just defined, any theory in which the nominal diagram commutes, will automatically be non-signaling. So if the red diagram commutes, the turquoise or whatever it is diagram will also commute automatically. And this is not surprising. If there is no action, if any local, any theory which is local at the nominal level has to be local at the phenomenal level, which means non-signaling. So this is quite obvious, but there's a proof. The point, there's no point going through the proof itself, but I just want to show that it's a quite a simple proof. And so this is a complete proof that local realism implies no signaling, which again is not a surprising statement. In the middle here, you have local realism. This equals that. That the red parts are equal. That's exactly what local realistic means. And that the blue parts are equal is what non-signaling means. All right. So again, theorem one is not surprising. Theorem two is more interesting. Theorem two says that non-signaling theories are local realistic. The proof is much simpler, in fact, because it's just false. Of course it's false. Quantum mechanics, standard conventional quantum mechanics, is non-signaling, but it's not local realistic because of Bell's theorem, because of the way Bell's theorem is usually interpreted. So no, this is not true. So let's try again. Theorem two, non-signaling theories can be made local realistic. By which I mean that if you choose the nominal states properly, so this is the main point of the entire talk. No matter which non-signaling theory you have, which is a statement at the phenomenal level, there is a way to lift it to a nominal level, which is local realistic. And again, standard quantum mechanics does not do that. And this theorem includes quantum mechanics, not standard, not conventional, but if done correctly, if you allow me. this theorem applies to quantum mechanics because quantum mechanics is non-signaling. It also applies to the PR non-local box, which also is non-signaling. And worth mentioning, not only because Sandhu is here, but because the way to do that with the PR box is intuitively more interesting than the way to do it with quantum theory. So the PR box was invented by Sandhu and Daniel Rohrisch about 20 years, bit more than 20 years ago. It was very fundamental. Much more recently, Sandhu wrote in Nature Physics a really nice review article on non-locality, where again, of course, he talks about the PR box. There was maybe, unfortunately, Sandhu, I don't know if I'm sure he didn't do that on purpose, but this really nice review article came out on the 1st of April. And it's very unfortunate.
Well, at least he has.
Because, of course, full of crazy ideas. full of crazy in the sense of explaining devices that we know cannot exist in, at least according to quantum mechanics. But nevertheless, in both papers, Sandhu talk about non-locality being a theorem or the most characteristic feature of quantum mechanics. And the point of this talk is I disagree. Because to me, despite its name, the non-local box has a local explanation. It can be implemented locally. Not in our world, of course, because in our world you can't implement it at all. But it's possible to invent a toy universe in which non-local boxes exist, and this universe is local realistic, thus proving that non-local boxes are not necessarily non-local. They don't have to be. And since they don't exist in real life, then we can invent them any way we want. All right. So this theorem two, again, is that any non-signaling theory can be lifted at numinal level to be local realistic. There are caveats. It is true and completely proven when the underlying structure, algebraic structure under the phenomenal theory is a group. So if this U is indeed a group action, then the theorem is proven. If it's just a monoid, we still have loose ends to tie, and it may turn out to be false. But in case of quantum mechanics and the PR box, it works fine. So what I want to do now is to illustrate this idea. Before I do that, of course, until now you might have thought, oh, how come this guy hasn't heard of Bell's theorem? Me, this guy. Well, of course I have. Before I go any further, I must tell you why what I've been telling you about is not obviously false. I'll try to convince you it's true afterwards. But first, why is it that it's not obviously false? Because it's often thought that Bell said it's impossible for nature to be local realistic. This is not meant as an exact quote, but these words are usually put in Bell's mouth. And in fact, sorry to say that, he did say something very much like that. Of course, assuming that quantum mechanics is phenomenally correct. But by now, there's been enough experiments that we don't really doubt about quantum mechanics being phenomenally correct. So, said otherwise, the prediction of quantum mechanics cannot be realized in a world that would be local realistic. That's what people think of as Bell's theorem. And therefore, that what I just told you about from the start is nonsense. And in fact, Bell did say something like that, not in these words, but not in his 1964 paper. In his famous 1964 paper with Bell, from which Bell's inequalities are derived, he didn't say something like that at all. But in the Nouvelle-Cuisine paper, which is his very, very last paper, the very last paper in his career, he did say that. That quantum mechanics cannot be local realistic. The original paper didn't say that. Before I tell you what the original paper said, and I have no issue with that, let me just quote Bell again, this time quote him exactly, about something else. Now see, Bell is best known for this impossibility result. But he also said that what is proved by impossibility proofs is a lack of imagination. It's quite remarkable that he would poke fun at himself like that. Let's defer to someone else whose most profound, you're welcome to disagree, whose most profound statement is not E equals MC squared, but imagination is more important than knowledge. And so the point of all this is, instead of this statement, which is not proved, this has not been proved by Bell, because it's false, actually. What has been proved by Bell in his 1964 paper, is slightly different, but importantly different. What's impossible is not to explain quantum mechanics as a local realistic theory. It's to explain quantum mechanics with local hidden variables. And that's not the same thing. So if we can find a local realistic theory which is not based on local hidden variables, a different kind of local realism, then Bell's theorem just does not apply. It's just a matter of imagination. So this is what he said in 1964, and I have no issue with that. It's mathematically correct. All right. So is there some other local realistic way to do quantum mechanics other than local hidden variables? One that would require just a bit more imagination. And the answer is yes. And there are two ingredients to get there. One is despite all these tests of Bell inequalities that have been done in the lab many times, with or without various loopholes, and with fewer and fewer loopholes as the years go by, all these tests have one thing in common, which is not usually realized as being a loophole, but it certainly is. So the main contribution of Alain Aspect in the early 80s to Bell test violations, I remind you, was that before him, what Clauser had done in the 70s, Clauser is the first one who's actually tried to violate Bell's inequalities and succeeded, to his surprise. but it was a very, very short distance, and in Clauser's experiment, the so-called locality loophole was wide open. What Aspect did in 1981 and in 1982, in his third experiment in 82. What Aspect did was to have enough distance between the two particles that were entangled and to choose pseudo-randomly with an acoustic system, to choose pseudo-randomly which measurement to make on each side, and most importantly, that the choice of which measurement is not determined, well, it is determined because it's pseudo-random. But not obviously determined at the time that the pair of particles is emitted. And So this closed the locality loophole for the first time, and it seems very convincing, but it doesn't work. Logically speaking, it doesn't work. And here's the main caveat, is that the way that we say that usually, that we talk about these Bell experiments, is that Alice and Bob make these measurements, and the outcomes of these measurements seem to be unexplainable with classical theories. However, before we can say that, the whole point of an experiment is to test if it's true in nature, not just a crazy theory, but if it really happens. So we cannot say that the Bell inequality has been violated until we've compared the results. So you have a bunch of results at Alice's, a bunch of results at Bob's, and on each side, just seen by itself, there's nothing mysterious. It's only when you compare the results that you can validate Bell's inequality, statistically speaking. But you cannot compare the results until they're brought back together. And so Alice gets results, and Bob gets results, and this means nothing at all until they are compared. But to compare them, you have to bring them together, and that you cannot do faster than the speed of light. So the locality loophole has not been closed, and cannot be, by definition. So the process of comparing the result and say, aha, I violated Bell's inequality, that process cannot go faster than light.
Are you saying the results could change on routes back to the center? Or?
Good question. Of course, if you believe that the results were definite already when Alice and Bob measured, and they cannot change, they were fixed in stone already, then well, it doesn't matter whether you measure them, when you compare them there, which you cannot, or whether you have to wait till they're together. Right? So if they are set in stone when Alice and Bob measure, this makes no difference.
So if you actually set them in stone, you get some stones and you set them in stone, then it would be okay?
No.
Okay.
No, because...
So it's just a metaphor, right?
No, I understand. Of course. I said there were two keys. One is this. And in fact, they go together. The other key is that in order to claim that we have actually done Bell inequality tests, you have to believe not only that the results, you have to not only take that into account, but also that the measurement outcome, to go around the problem. Then you have to realize that measurement outcomes don't have to become fixed and definite. They never have to be set in stone. Now, when I say they don't have to be fixed and definite, I don't mean that they will change as they travel. That's not the point. That would be another way of doing it, perhaps, which I don't want to get into. What I mean here is that and all possible results can occur. We are used to thinking that only one result occurs, and that when it occurs is definite and it will not change. But we have no way of knowing that. So it could be that in case of binary measurement, for instance, it could be that both results occur. Now this, of course, smells of the many-world interpretation, and it's inspired by it. But I'm not talking about splitting the universe here. I'm talking about just the two results having occurred simultaneously, locally speaking. It's a purely local thing again. OK, the best way to illustrate this is by coming back to the non-local box. And there are two reasons to do that. One is that a non-local box is we know that it doesn't exist anyways. It cannot exist, at least if quantum mechanics is correct, at the phenomenal level. So since it cannot exist, if we want to talk about it, we're free to invent any world we want. Because we're not trying to find a new theory for the real world. but we can play the game. I'm going to implement the non-local box any way I want, and I'm going to do it the way I if I can do it local realistically, I'm in business. So here I'm not limited to trying to represent the real world because I know that I'm not doing so. The other advantage of talking about the non-local box is because the solution would be much, much simpler than quantum mechanics. But we know how to do quantum mechanics as well. Okay, let me just remind you what it is. Alice and Bob, well, there are two ways of saying it. We can either say that each have a box, or it's one non-local box that has one port at Alice, one port at Bob. I'm going to draw them separately, but it's one box, one non-local box. So the way it works, Alice and Bob put in their inputs X and Y, which are just single bits, and they get outputs A and B. And I'm going to, for sake of illustration, I will take A and B not as being 0 and 1, but as being blue and green, or red and green. And the rule of the non-local box, what it does, which is that's magical, this R here means random, means uniformly random, meaning that seen just from Alice's side, A is as likely to be red or green, independently of X or anything else, and B is as likely to be red or green as well. However, there would be a correlation. And the correlation is that if A and B are different bits, sorry, the outputs A and B will be different colors if and only if both inputs are one. So in all other cases, 0, 1, 0, 0, 1, 0, you will get the same color. And if both inputs X and Y are 1, you get two opposite colors, one red or green, one green or red, one red. But again, seen marginally on one side, it's completely random. Okay, only the correlation is given by the non-local box. Now, these boxes are atemporal in the sense that the way that I described before, you had both inputs that come at the same time, and the two outputs come out. That's what I just illustrated. But it doesn't have to be. These boxes are atemporal in the sense that Alice can put in her input, and she gets her output immediately. Doesn't have to wait for Bob's input to come in. And if later Bob put, and that output is purely random, uniform random. If later Bob puts in his input, then he will get his output, not random at all. Because now Bob's output is constrained by this correlation. So whoever puts the input first gets a random output, the other one gets an output which is determined by the output given to the first person. And of course in relativity, there's no clear notion of one being before the other. They could each be before the other in their respective reference frame. Makes no difference. And it's absolutely essential, because if Alice's box, if after Alice had put in her input, the box would wait to give the output until Bob puts in input, then that could be used for signaling. But because that's not the case, in fact, these boxes are, they cannot be used to communicate. In other words, these boxes correspond to a non-signaling scenario. And therefore, the theorem that I want to talk about applies to see that at the phenomenal level, they are non-signaling. Therefore, at a numinal level, they can be non-local. Okay. So they cannot be used to communicate because they're causally atemporal. It can be simulated with 75% probability classically. It's fairly obvious, but it cannot do any better. Not very hard to prove at all. And the most beautiful thing about these boxes is that it's so easy, in fact, to prove that you cannot do better than 75%. Whereas quantum mechanics gives us a way to implement them with an 85%, or roughly 85% probability of getting the right correlation. And this is why we say that the non-local box is non-local. Sorry, this is why we say that quantum mechanics is non-local, because quantum mechanics can implement the non-local box better than classical physics. And in terms of the CHSH, did I get it wrong? CHSH, yes, that's good, sorry. Bell inequality. the nanocoil box will violate it. More than quantum mechanics. That's right. And again, this is why we see that quantum mechanics is non-local, and the non-local box is even more non-local. But in fact, I'm going to show you that no, that's not true at all. The non-local box can be implemented locally. Again, it's going to be a toy universe. It's going to be local realistic. It's a toy universe, meaning it's not meant to represent reality. Again, because non-local box does not exist in reality anyways. So if I want to implement it, I'm free.
We don't know. We haven't found them yet.
Okay.
Probably.
If quantum mechanics is correct at the phenomenal level, then the non-local box cannot be implemented in real life. But of course, quantum mechanics could be totally wrong. Of course. But the main point of all this exercise, and this is what I want to stress most, is that once I will have convinced you, I hope, that a non-local box can be implemented local realistically, and then you can no longer claim. Because a non-local box violates Bell's inequality, so I will show you in extremely simple manner that there is a world that violates Bell's inequalities. I'm going to show it to you in a minute. There is a world that violates Bell's inequality even more than quantum mechanics. And that world is local realistic. And that in itself is a clear proof that the mere violation of Bell's inequality in our world does not imply that our world is non-local. That doesn't prove that our world is local. I'm not saying that. But I'm saying that just because our world violates Bell's inequality through quantum mechanics, just from this, you cannot conclude that it's non-local. Because there is some other world, not ours, that violates Bell's inequality even more and is local. Okay. So what applies to quantum mechanics is just the blue statement here. Again, so far it will not prove that quantum mechanics can be made local, which I will show you afterwards. All right, just to remind you what it is before I give you the construction, just be sure that everyone is familiar with it now. Whenever the inputs are just one bit each, whenever both inputs is one, we have to get two different colors. And in all three other cases, we get the same color. That's the definition. Okay. That's a poster that explains how to do it. Of course, I don't expect that you can read that. But I brought copies. I'll take them out now before I forget. If you're interested, you can go home with it. Let me just show you these two parts of it, here and here. So Alice and Bob, as you've seen, they're in spaceships, right? So Alice and Bob, they each have this box. The pair of boxes is in fact one non-local box again. But I'm going to talk about two boxes for simplicity. So Alice and Bob, they each have these magical box with a button, 0 and 1 buttons on top. And whenever Alice or Bob pushes on one or the other of the buttons on his or her box, the box will light up either green or red. And so they have the 0, 1 button. When it's pushed, the box flashes green or red and looks perfectly random, seen marginally from Alice and Bob's point of view. But what they will discover later when they meet later, they will discover that every time that they both push the one button, they get different colors. And in all other cases, they get the same color. So how can this be explained? Well, it's explained like this. No, this is, sorry. This is what I just said. That it flashes red or green, and you do the experiment, and it does exactly what as specified by the boxes, right? So they get together, they compare the results, they say, oh, these boxes are magical. These boxes must be non-local. But in fact, now I'm going to show you how to do that, how to implement these boxes, not in real life, but in the toy universe. So Alice and Bob, they have their boxes, they're in spaceships, they're far apart. And at the moment, one or the other, in this case Alice, will do it first, without lots of generality. So at the moment Alice pushes her a button, she will see her box glow green or red. But unbeknownst to her, she will also see the other color. What will happen really is that Alice and her spaceship and the box will split. As if they were in a bubble, they will split. There will be two Alices. One sees red, one sees green, and they have no conscience of the other whatsoever. They're in the same physical place in space, but they are superposed. Sorry, wrong button. So Alice pushed the one button. When Alice pushes the one button, she splits. One Alice sees green, the other one sees red. Nothing whatsoever at Bob's. It's far away, no action at distance. Let's say that Bob pushes the zero button. Then Bob splits as well. One Bob saw green, one Bob saw red. So I have two Alices, they don't see each other. Two Bobs, they don't see each other. And now they're going to meet, just to compare the result. And that's where everything happens. Until now, everything was local here, everything was local there. And when they meet, which they cannot do faster than the speed of light, it's only when they meet that the bubbles will do the correct pairing so that it works. So because the bubbles know which button was pushed, in this case it was a one and a zero button, therefore it's not a 1-1 case, meaning they should see the same color. The bubbles know when they meet. They don't know beforehand because the Alice's bubble doesn't know what happened at Bob's bubble. But when they meet, they can tell. So when they meet, Alice's bubble and Bob's bubble see that that they have to show the same color because it's not a 1-1 button that were pushed. And therefore, the green Alice will see the green Bob, and the red Alice will see the red Bob. And just as the two Alices didn't see each other and the two Bobs didn't see each other, the green Alice will not see the red Bob, and vice versa. So Alice, both Alices, will meet the Bob that they have to meet to conclude, oh, it worked. And of course, it could have been anything else. It could have been Alice, sorry about that. All right, so that's what we just seen. Of course, it such as that was Alice 0 and Bob, Alice 1, Bob 0. Of course, it could have been Alice 0, Bob 1, which would have the same end result that green sees green, red sees red, or 1 and 1, in which case now it's green Alice will see red Bob, because it's 1-1, which is a case where you should see different colors. And everything is local. So you can see it's crazy, bubbles, splitting, parallel world, that's ridiculous. I don't care. This is a toy universe. I can invent it anyone I want. But it's clearly a local, realistic universe. And it does exactly what the non-local box is supposed to do. All right, so again, the key idea is that we get around the EPR argument. The EPR argument was, let me remind you, 1935. The EPR argument was that if, without in any way, what was the word? I should quote exactly, but anyways. So if without any way, it's not disturbing, observing, measuring, maybe disturbing. If Alice does something If I do something here which is far away from here, therefore has no effect there, and if by doing this I can tell what will be measured there, what the state here, therefore the state had to be already predefined. This was to go against the Copenhagen interpretation. And no. That's not all the correct reasoning. In this universe that I described, let's say that Alice pushes the zero button. Right? Maybe she pushed one in my thing, but let's say that Alice pushes the zero button. If Alice pushes the zero button and she sees red, then she will think that she knows that if no matter which button Bob pushes, he will also see red. Because she pushed zero. If Alice pushed zero, it's not going to be a 1-1 case. It's not a 1-1 case, it should be the same color. But if Alice pushes zero and sees red, she will say, oh, I know, because I believe the boxes work, I know that Bob will also see red. But that's the wrong reasoning. Because there's another Alice who saw green, and she will say, I know that Bob will see green. They're both right. In fact, they're both wrong. Because what really happens is not that by pushing the button, you can predict what's happening far away. This is not true at all. What you can predict by pushing the button is not what's happening at Bob's simultaneously, because nothing is happening at Bob's simultaneously. This is a local universe. What Alice can tell by pushing a button and seeing the color is not what's happening at Bob's at the same time. It's how their various lives will meet in the future. Alice, by pushing zero and seeing red, all she can tell is that the Bob that she will meet is one that has seen red. She cannot see anything. There's nothing actually happened in Bob's at that time. All right, so again, the lesson here is that it is wrong to claim that any world that violates Bell's inequality has to be local. And the proof is complete that this is wrong by this very simple Torrey example. But now we have to do quantum mechanics. And I will not go through the entire thing because it would take too much time, and because it would be totally boring, actually. But the good news is that you have this very nice poster that I showed you before. On the other side, you have quantum mechanics. So you can look at it at your leisure. I'm not going to go through proofs and proofs after proof that everything works. It would be totally boring. But I just want to flip through the slides to show you that it's not that complicated without trying to go into any detail. So we have to define a nominal state now. So the nominal state, MA, that's the nominal state of system A, will be defined by a matrix. One thing that we have in common with standard quantum mechanics is the notion of dimension. So if I have a d-dimensional system, it will be described by a d by d matrix, just as the ordinary density matrix is a d by d matrix. Except that the density matrix is a d by d matrix of just of complex numbers. In this case, we a d by d matrix of matrices. Each matrix will record the experience that this system has had with the rest of the universe. Technically, it's written like this. This is a here's dimension n. So, all right, so dimension n. Not D. So I have a dimension n, so I'm going to have an n by n matrix, each entry of which is a matrix that contains something that looks like the usual density matrix stuff, tensored with the identity and the rest of the universe, on which acts a matrix which does not have to be known, which cannot be known from system A, actually. This matrix is unknown to system A, because it talks about the whole universe. This matrix corresponds to everything that's happened in the universe since the beginning of time. But I stress that locally at system A, you don't need to know anything about that except what's happened to you and your previous interactions. Because this thing will be, in terms of system A, this matrix would be invariant about W outside of your, not W itself, but if you change this matrix W, corresponding to the rest of the universe, things that you have not interacted with, you get the same thing here. So that's the sense in which this is defined locally, despite the appearance of this global W. So it's not local mathematically, it's local physically, it's nominally local. Anyways, again, I don't want to get into the technical details, but once you have defined the state like this, the nominal state like this, then evolution. If you have the system A, it's also. I'm sorry. I'm going to this what I call MA as a nominal state before. I'm going to call it WA now. The ijth element of WA is here, but think of this W in bracket as what I called M before. Technically, I have to do that. It's a bit annoying. But once you've defined it that way, then the evolution, so if you want to evolve A, system A, so it's the nominal state of system A, you want to evolve it under unitary U, which is U is an ordinary unitary, as you've always used them. So I'm going to get with, in a discrete fashion here. Instead of pushing Hamiltonians, I apply unitaries. Well, then that's the definition. You know, and I don't want to go through it, but just to show it's reasonably simple. So once you've done that, there's a theorem. This is a theorem about locality. This theorem tells you that if you apply U to the nominal state of A, you get the same thing as if you apply U to A and anything you want to the rest of the universe. Makes no difference because it's local. And that's a proof. So that's a theorem. This is a theorem of locality. This proves that the system is local. I mean, this statement says that it's local. And the proof is one page. Okay. Again, I won't go through it, but it's very simple. That you can separate. Now I had to define both the pi as a projection operator and the O dot join operator. I have to define them both. So the projection operator is defined in an extremely simple way as well. And then the theorem says that if you take an arbitrary system on A and no matter what else, could be just something small or the rest of the universe, and if you project onto A, you do get the state of A. And here's the proof. Aqua, even simpler. And then merging. That merging is a thing that does not exist with standard quantum mechanics. Splitting does exist, but not merging. But I do have here. So merging, if you have the nominal state of A and B, then the merge operation is even more simpler. And theorem, if you take if you merge A with B, you get AB. Proof, one page. And then how do you get the phenomenal state? How do you get the row, the density matrix from the nominal state M or W? Well, that's a formula. You need to choose an arbitrary so-called reference vector, a reference state here, and then you get a density matrix like this. And again, this shows that that all the diagrams commute, and the proof is again one page. The density matrix is obtained by this formula, really, which we interpret as a proportion, not as a probability. It's a proportion of atlases that have seen one thing versus some seeing something else. But they will interpret that as a probability because they don't know about the other atlases. So there's no probability here. Everything is, and our entire concept of probability in terms of chance is an illusion. But it's an illusion which is exactly predicted by the theory, that you would perceive it that way, even though it doesn't exist really. And then separate evolution, that if you evolve A and B together or separately, you get the same thing. Even simpler proof. And we have the commuting diagram to evolve and then evolve the nominal state and predict a phenomenal state, or predict first and evolve then. You get the same thing. Here's the proof. And the other commuting diagram, that if you project a state into a system into a subsystem, then the nominal and the nominal and the nominal level, then the phenomenal levels will work as well. Where projection at the phenomenal level is the same as the usual trace in quantum mechanics, but this is different. This is what we've defined specifically. Well, there's a proof. Simple. All right. Let me wrap up by coming back to the other presentation by saying that none of this effect is new. Everything I told you about it. Well, sorry. How to do the PR box in this very simple fashion is totally original. How to do the rest of quantum mechanics is not new, but we've done it in a way that is a lot simpler than before. In fact, they were precursors with enough imagination, and in particular, Everett, of course. But the standard Everett relative state formulation that became known as the many world interpretation is not, on the face of it, a local theory at all. The purpose of Everett was not to make quantum mechanics local. The purpose of Everett was to get rid of the measurement problem. If you think of many world as the universe splitting, of course, if the whole universe splits every time you sneeze, that's not a very local thing. and if you think that that all the universe is split already, there are infinitely many splits that's already out there, you just have to branch in whichever universe you want to be. Well, if you think of it that way, if you have if you share a singlet, and if Alice measures here, then the only branch in which Alice will still be, or those in which Bob will see the same result, that's not local either. So many world in itself is not a local theory. But still, it was an important starting point. It was Frank Tipler, I think, that realized that many world could be turned into a local theory. And he told David Deutsch about it, and David Deutsch published it. I'm not saying that he stole the result, of course not. With due credit, with Patrick Hayden in the year 2000. So based on my knowledge, the first time that there was an explicit paper on a local realistic version of quantum mechanics was Deutsch and Hayden. Although to call it explicit is a bit of a stretch, because that paper doesn't say anything about local realism. And it doesn't say that because Deutsch is so convinced that everybody believes in local realism that it's not even worth mentioning it. So it's kind of weird. It's extremely cryptic. The paper is very, very cryptic. But if you really read it, good luck, that's what it says. And there's this really nice book by, well, Colin Jack is the guy's name, but his pen name is Colin Bruce. And he wrote this book, Schrödinger's Rabbits. It's a popular science book, and in it, in fact, there is something extremely, extremely similar to the story I told you about non-local boxes. Although he doesn't talk about non-local boxes, but the way that he explains locality in quantum mechanics is very similar to the story I told you. What we've done is simpler. I believe. Of course, it's always simpler when you do it yourself. But I believe that it's objectively simpler than Deutsch and Hayden. And also one thing I did not mention, and it's time is running out, so I will only state it without trying to justify it unless you ask questions. The main point where we diverge from orthodox Everettianism is that it is my perception, at least, that most Everettians take it for granted that the universal wave function, the wave function of the universe, is the noumenal state of the universe. That if you want to describe all there is to know about the universe physically, the only way to do that for an Everettian is give me the wave function of the universe and I will know everything there is to know. We proved that this is not the case. What we proved is that any theory, any local relativistic theory of quantum mechanics, let me say it again, in any local relativistic theory of quantum mechanics, defined the way we did, by which I mean with the red diagram of what local relativistic means. If you agree that this is what local relativistic should mean, then it's a theorem that this is bound to fail if you take the wave function of the universe as the complete description of the universe. You need to have more stuff. For instance, what we have here, or something else. But by itself, the wave function cannot be the noumenal state, even at a universal level. It's obviously true at this, at the local system level, but it's also true at a universal level. So I would say this is the main place where we totally disagree with standard Everettian. All right. I guess I should stop here. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
Yeah.
I would be interested in whether your definition of noumenal states,
yes,
is it in any sense unique or...
Sorry, is it what?
Is it in any sense unique, the definition, or do you
no.
just...
We found one solution to the problem that we asked, which is to lift. So our first self-imposed constraint was to keep quantum mechanics at the phenomenal level the same. In other words, our purpose was to have a theory which has exactly the same prediction, but then to lift it at a noumenal level that's local realistic. There's no pretension, this is the only solution. It's the simplest we could find, but along the way, we there were many iterations that became simpler and simpler and simpler. At the moment, that's the simplest we have. It's quite
the
simple.
The notion of nominality is basically defined by the properties you derive
then from the problem. Well, our constraints on the noumenal level is that it should project on the phenomenal level to correspond to quantum mechanics, and it should be local realistic. I mean, it's being noumenal is realistic, and it should be local. So we have the our self-imposed constraints to define a noumenal level. Again, it should project to the phenomenal level, which is density matrices, and it should have this property that you can split system, evolve them separately, and join them, and get the right thing. Get the right thing when you phenomenalize it. So under those, so we fulfill those conditions, and therefore we have a local realistic interpretation of quantum mechanics. We're not claiming it's the best one, and even as the only one. That's what we found so far. Yes.
So can you just justify the last claim a little
yes.
bit more? How did you prove that the universal wave function can be completely descriptive? Is that partly because of the constraints you're putting on the noumenal level?
Oh.
And
yeah, there were questions.
Wave function cannot meet them.
Yes, I. Let's ask. It's not that difficult. So that's a statement. I think this very much. What this really says is that the wave function, as we are taught, or the density matrix, in either case, it's but a shadow of the real world. The real world is at a noumenal level, and the wave function is a shadow of it. And
I'm just going to take over chair.
Sure, sure. No, that's all right. No, of course, of course. I mean,
you should be going. It's
all right, all right, all right. Sure, 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 sure. So now the theorem is it's not so hard to prove with a simple example. In fact, the example will be the proof. Let me just remind you that we have these two of the Bell state, the phi plus and psi plus, 0, 0 plus 1, 1, 0, 0 1 plus 1, 0. So what I do, and we have the negation gate, which flips 0 to 1 and 1 to 0. What I'm going to do is that I start with phi plus, and if we want to have a local realistic world, we need a noumenal level because it's realistic, and the noumenal level must be so that, because it's local, so that we can split phi plus into the A and B part. That's part of the things that we claim that we need to have, right? So if you disagree so far, no point listening anymore. So once we agree, if we do, that phi plus, whatever it is really, it's this mysterious thing, whatever it is could be in fact noumenally split between A and B, if we believe that, then by the separate evolution theorem, we could negate each side independently, locally, negate whatever it is that's noumenally a half pi plus, psi plus, we could negate each side locally, but in standard quantum mechanics, we're going to go back and forth between standard and my thing. In standard quantum mechanics, if you negate both sides of the phi plus, you still get a phi plus. 0, 0 plus 1, 1 becomes 1, 1 plus 0, 0. And now if we trace out B, meaning we project into A, if we project into A, then the noumenal state, M is a noumenal state. The noumenal state of A has to be N, the negation of the noumenal state before negation. Sorry, I'm not saying it right. I'm not saying it right, sorry.
That's okay.
Yeah, that's right. So this is equal to that. That's right. This is equal to that. And therefore, if we project into A, this is equal to that. So we get that MA is the same as the negation of MA at a noumenal level. However, phi plus, not psi, phi plus in standard quantum mechanics is obtained by negating only one side and not touching the other side of psi plus. And therefore, splitting and recombining, it has to be the same n of psi plus, n of one half of psi plus, as we see here, has to be the same. Sorry, we get n of one half of psi plus by separate evolution that you join again with the identity on the other side of psi plus. So this is one half and the other half of psi plus. Of the psi plus I started with, but I only negate one half of it, so I get this. But this is equal to that, therefore I get that, but this is in fact psi plus. So we get phi plus equal to psi plus, which is a contradiction. And this contradiction is obtained because we believed, wrongly of course, that there was nothing else to the noumenal state than a wave function. So there was nothing about the universe here. It was just, even if we restrict the universe to only two particles, that already we cannot have that the wave function is a noumenal state.
But basically, in general, you place a constraint on the noumena, which the wave function topology cannot meet. And the reason.
Let me just say it again. To say for a prediction that it's okay to take the wave function as a noumenal state would mean that The only way to get cyclops, there is only one way to get cyclops, because it's a numeral set already. I'll let you finish your question.
Oh, just the general structure, it sounded like you're placing a particular constraint on the numinal realm.
Yes.
And then you were proving that the wave function only ontology couldn't meet it.
That's yeah.
But the purpose of placing that constraint in the first place was to recover local realism?
Yes.
But
the purpose was to... The constraint is that any numinal state of more than one system can be split, evolved separately, and recombined. If you take those as axioms, as things that you want to have in your theory, then you get this.
Well, what's puzzling me, if that was the goal of postulating that, at the end of your talk, you said that the Everettian picture can recover locality. You said in the early Everett picture they couldn't, but then you talked about these later Everett pictures, Deutschenhagen, and you said they recovered locality.
Yeah.
So then.
But they don't use the wave function, universal wave function as the. You don't talk about numeral states, but in those papers, much as I've done here, you need to add stuff to the wave function. Those papers will not have at the end of the day that the universal wave function is the entire state of the universe. Which does not mean that they realized that when you wrote it, but it's there. It has to be there. It's impossible otherwise. So if you're with me that you want a local, realistic interpretation which has again these properties that you can split a system, evolve separately, and recombine, then that's enough to prove that you cannot do that by taking the wave function as the numinal state. That's what it says.
Other questions?
Oh, and also, sorry. Maybe a simpler statement to prove, which I will spare you, but a simpler statement to prove is that this function, this epimorphism phi, that goes from numinal to phenomenal, cannot be one-to-one. And therefore, once you see that this cannot be one-to-one, it follows that that a wave function cannot be in a numinal state, because for a given density matrix of a pure state, there would be only one wave function. It would have to be one-to-one, but it's not. Sorry, yes.
So I have some questions as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, in fact, two of them. So first of all, you do agree that if you would have a theory in which each Edison bulb only sees one result,
not a multiverse,
then it must be no longer.
Yes, I agree. Well, sorry, no. There's
a constraint that they can only see one.
No.
Then there is one result.
I'm sorry. The answer is no, because no theory can rule out superdeterminism.
Up to superdeterminism.
Or that we live in a matrix, or that God is just laughing at us.
Yeah.
So there are all kinds of crazy theory that can be invented that are local and purely deterministic and not at all quantum mechanics, but give the same observations just because God is laughing at us. But if you rule those out, right, so if you rule those out, so what Paul, my student, did at some point was to list things that we wouldn't like the universe to follow. And then prove that can't have them all. Sounds like what Bell did somehow, but with a specific list. So we have to give up at least one. And what this boils down to is that if we don't take account of the crazy explanations, and then there's a neat list. And you have to renounce one of them, but you can renounce only one of them. In particular, if you're not willing to renounce If you want to keep the belief that a measurement is definite, then you have to accept that the world is non-local. That's the answer to your question. Yeah, it's a choice, but it's really a choice between the two. Now, whether it's our choice or God's choice, well, not my problem.
the other question is, here you presented a sort of, this is probably the simplest scenario. But for example, in your teleportation, you first Alice does and then things go, and there's a bit of classical communication. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I presume that in the end, you can transform into this.
But yes, yes.
Are there any special points with that?
Well, even though the formalism is reasonably simple, that I showed you, it's reasonably simple, it's not baby simple. I must admit that it quickly becomes very painful. Even just to exhibit what happens if you just do a test of Bell's inequality on one singlet, it's not that easy, because you would think that to do a test of Bell inequality of one singlet, there are only two particles of the singlet, and you measure one or the other. No, because to do the measurement in this setting, to do a measurement really means to entangle the particle with the measurement apparatus or with the observer. So you need more, the number of systems that you have to consider before you can even start to talk about one Bell experiment is unpleasant. So it's not so easy to follow these things through examples. And teleportation is a bit harder, but it has to work.
I just want to make a comment that
you
can always do this by keeping, you know, all the entire history of everything that was done, especially if there are more measurements. But I saw the format is very compact.
So
it's really quite impressive when you draw that.
Thank you.
I would also be interested in the quote you mentioned in the beginning by Wheeler.
Yes. It's a quote by Chris Fuchs about Wheeler.
Okay.
Yes.
So the notion of information that Wheeler had in mind, is it the same notion of information you're using, or one of the different?
No, what he had in mind is what really was my main project earlier, in an earlier life, which is to start with information theoretic principles and derive quantum mechanics from it. This is not really what I talked about. So I would say that the best approximation to what Wheeler wanted is the Kuribella, Dariano, and Perinetti result of 5 years ago or so, which maybe 10.
The notion of information he had in mind. Is it the notion of information people are having in mind right now?
I think what he had in mind is start from the way that quantum mechanics tells us that information can be manipulated and cannot be manipulated. For instance, no cloning, no signaling. So you start with that to state in terms of purely in terms of ways by which information can be manipulated. You state prove theorems from standard quantum mechanics. You get theorems on how information can be manipulated. Then you take these theorems. You choose which ones to take to keep. You make a right selection and you call them axioms. You turn the table around and now derive quantum mechanics. I think that's what he had in mind. It certainly is what I had in mind. And from my perspective, Kuribella solved it to a large extent with Perinetti and Dariano. So, whereas what I did here is somewhat different. Now I'm using, what I'm doing here really is to try to determine what information has to be somewhat stored in physical systems for the universe to be local. So if you want a local universe, then information has to be somewhere in the physical world. How much information, what information? That's more like what I've done. And is it too much information? Some people will say this is just too much information is needed. It's not reasonable. There's no way it can be done, and therefore the world is not local. Fine. That's a reasonable answer. Yeah.
One comment on that is that it seems like that extra information is exactly what everyone wants to use to do quantum computation. So if there was not some extra information, we'd be missing some of the potential advantages.
Well, yeah. Well, yes, I mean, and as you probably know, the real motivation for David Deutsch to investigate a quantum computer was that in his mind, if we build one and it works, that will prove that many world is correct. Because in his mind, there's no way that quantum computing, that this at least apparent exponential amount of parallelism could take place in a single universe. So for him, once you factor a 1,000-digit number, and once you also prove that it's not possible classically, we don't know what to do, in his mind, we'll finally have proven that quantum mechanics is, that Everett is right. And in his mind, probably that Everett is right with the universal wave function being discovered in the universe, which is wrong. So that was his motivation. Now, I'm not sure I buy that. Probably don't. Is there really no other way to explain quantum computing than having this vast parallelism in multiverse? I don't know. But yes, you need information somewhere. That's right.
Other questions? Well, if not, let's thank again you.